brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. Across from me is one Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And since there's a couple of microphones in front of us, that would make this Stuff You Should Know the all-audio podcast, all goodness, all the time.
And in the other room is guest producer Elizabeth, Lizzie.
Yeah.
Our old buddy is back here working.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Giving us pieces of dried mango.
And in between, she worked for Emily, and so I haven't been able to lose Lizzie.
That's good. She's not one you want to lose. Lizzie's no. Awesome. Stop picking on Lizzie, Chuck.
I'm a big fan. I started the Lizzie fan club here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I dissolved it.
I was going to say, I've not been invited to that.
It was just me.
Chuck, you remember when we were on the call with a senior White House official yesterday?
Yeah, that was kind of cool, huh?
Yeah.
White House.
Yeah, Obama administration.
That's who's in there.
Basically, we were talking about the, we were basically going over the talking points for the energy security policy that he unveiled today.
Yes.
As of this recording, March 31st, right?
That's right. 30th. And,
oh, is tomorrow the 31st?
Yeah, that's right.
March 30th. So he goes over this, or she's going over this with us. And basically, Obama has said that over the next decade, he wants to reduce American oil imports by a third, right?
That's something that every president, going back to, I think, Nixon has said that. Same
okay.
Thing.
All right. So it's an ambitious goal is what you're saying.
Well, not necessarily a third, but yeah, there's a video that Jon Stewart ran on The Daily Show where it literally showed the same clip from like our last five presidents.
It's awesome.
Saying reduce foreign dependency on oil.
They have the best researchers on that show.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, Obama took his rightful place following in the footsteps of Richard Nixon and has said that he wants to reduce our imports by a third in about 10 years. And one way to do that is to figure out how to conserve oil, how to reduce use,
mm-hmm.
e.g. a smarter grid, more wind power, more nuclear, more...
clean coal? At the end of
clean
that?
Coal was another one. Natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
No. Clean coal, and to basically get online our reserves that we have now.
Right.
So the big talking point around Washington with the Democrats right now is that oil is the oil companies have leases on something like 79 million acres
mm-hmm.
of oil land.
Right.
Suspected oil land
that we're not tapping. Right.
That's not being used.
Yeah.
They just own these leases. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think like 19 million acres are actually being mined for their oil.
Right.
Or natural gas. And Obama's position is, hey, you fat cats, you need to go ahead and start producing or else we're going to penalize you.
Like invest in the United States.
Yeah, come off some of these profits and start spending on exploration and production.
Right.
And get American oil out of the ground, which is hugely different than what he was saying he should do before.
Right.
Which is like no offshore drilling, nothing like that.
Right.
So it's kind of a big deal that he's really putting oil at the center of his energy security policy. But one thing we asked that they didn't really answer very well is what role does preventing speculation in the commodities market play
right.
in energy security? My question.
I get the sense... And this is one of those topics, again, that, you know, Chuck's little guitar-playing English major brain has a hard time wrapping around this.
Yeah.
But I get the feeling that there's not a lot of people in the government that want to talk a lot about oil speculation. It's sort of like, don't bring that up.
No, which is strange because it's whole, you know, there was that whole kicking around Wall Street during the recession
mm-hmm.
thing that was going on. And that seems to have been largely abandoned.
Right.
But... the question of whether or not oil speculation is affecting oil prices today it still remains. Oil's up to, I think, AAA saying a national average of 360 right now for unleaded, for regular.
That's a national average?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. That's crippling.
Yeah.
Well, I know the recession ended. I just made air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
But people are hurting. Food prices are increasing. oil prices are increasing, gas prices are increasing, and a $3.60 gallon of gas is crippling to the average American.
Yeah, and that's average. I mean, you go to some places like California, and they're in the summertime, they may be creeping up over $5 a gallon.
Yeah. So
a lot of money for a gallon of gas.
Yes, it is. A barrel of oil today is trading for, OPEC, by the way, it stands to make $1 trillion in revenues in 2011. That's the course it's on right now.
That's a lot of cash.
Yeah,
I can't even say it.
So there's this idea out there that oil trading at $115 a barrel should actually be trading at something like $90 a barrel.
Right.
And that oil speculation is accounting for $20 to $25 on top of the barrel price, and accounts for a lot of this increase in the price of oil. So this is nothing new. This is going on right now in 2011, but it just happened in 2008. Do you remember when oil hit $4 a gallon? It hit $4.11 as a national average, which is the highest ever.
Yeah.
I remember July 14th, 2007. So 2007, 2008.
Yeah, I remember when it took the first big jump, whenever that was. I was living in L.A., and I remember it got over $2 a gallon, and it was a big jump. It was like one weekend it was, you know, $1.85, then the next weekend it was like $2.35.
That would have probably been like 2003 or 2004.
Yeah, it was a big, it was like a 50-cent jump or something like that. Don't quote me, I'm going on my feeble memory. But I remember saying at the time, you know what, I just had a feeling. Said, this is something different. Gas is never going to be this cheap again.
Never going to go back down. You know, in 1999, the average was 90 cents a gallon. 1999, it was so 12 years ago, 90 cents a gallon. Now we're at 360. We've already hit four and change for an average.
Yeah,
right?
I remember filling the little Honda up for like, you know, $14.
Yes, that was just so beautiful.
And now
it
it's like
so good.
$60.
Yeah. So, Chuck, from 2004 to 2008, the price of a barrel of crude oil increased from $31.61 in 2004 to $137.11 in July 2008.
Crazy.
Right? So gas prices grew from $193 to $409 over that same period. There's a lot of things. There's so much that goes into oil production that could affect the markets.
Yeah.
Instability. Right now, people are taking to the streets of Yemen and Syria, and once in a while in Iran. They are overthrowing the government in Egypt. There's a civil war going on in Libya. Libya's oil production is virtually offline right now.
Yeah.
So
Venezuela, a little unstable.
It depends on who you're asking. It's actually pretty stable. It's just socialist, which is why everybody's like, oh, that's a dangerous country.
Well, yeah, sure.
If you're America, it is. Right,
but that's one of the reasons that people said, you know, geopolitics and these unstable regions that produce oil has a lot to do with it. But Michigan Senator Carl Levin, during a hearing, said, you know what? Yeah, it's unstable, but it's been unstable for decades.
And we've been buying oil from them, no problem.
So that's not the reason, or that's what he claimed, at least.
Right. And Hugo Chavez, remember, through Citgo, that's the Venezuelan oil company.
Right.
That's here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Through Citgo. Remember, he used to donate like 1 million gallons of heating oil to people in the Northeast to keep them alive.
Right.
And that was like basically him saying, like, this is what socialism gets you, people of Boston. What do you think of that?
How warm are you?
Yeah, so it's unstable in that he's not a friend of America. We're not capable of pushing him around, and we need their oil.
Right.
But we have a detente because people like money. Economies like money, and we want to buy their oil, so everybody just chill out. What's more, with this recent drop in production that's represented by Libya going into civil war, Saudi Arabia stepped up and said, you know what, that's 3% of the oil that's produced every day,
right?
And we're going to add an extra 3% to make up for this temporary shortfall.
Right.
So there actually isn't any kind of dent in the production or supply side.
Well, no, because you mentioned in the article, like, could it be peak oil? But no, it's not peak oil.
Well, tell them what peak oil is.
Well, peak oil, did we not podcast on that yet?
No, we never have.
Yeah, we need to do that. That's the point where, you know, there's only a finite amount of oil. So once we cross that little threshold, it's like all of a sudden there's getting less and less oil.
Yeah, and there's a whole group of people out there, very educated, smart people. They're not crackpots, although sometimes people look at them like that, who believe we have passed peak oil, and it's going to take us 5 years or 10 years to figure it out. But by that time, it'll be way too late, and the world's going to come to a grinding halt for a while until we can figure out what to do. A lot of people think that we haven't hit peak oil, and if you look at least the published figures,
right.
Saudi Arabia is often accused of fudging on their numbers. I think they were found to a while back. But most people say, no, supply still exceeds demand,
right.
Which, if you look at Mr. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, the basis of the capitalist economy,
mm-hmm.
if supply exceeds demand, prices should remain low.
And oil is not the kind of thing you want rewriting the rules of base economics.
No, because ultimately it's a commodity. And a commodity is something that we can make things out of or something we need. Wheat is a commodity. We need that.
Pork belly.
Pork belly is a commodity.
It's my favorite
one. The most delicious commodity.
Yes.
And oil is a very, very vital commodity. So if Carl Levin's saying, yeah, that's unstable, but we can deal with them.
Right.
If Saudi Arabia is saying, yes, Libya is offline right now.
Right.
But we're going to make up the shortfall. If we haven't actually passed peak oil and the supply still exceeds the demand,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people are saying, why is oil so high? Why is it increasing and increasing? And there's a correlation that's going on right now.
Right.
The answer to that, obviously, for a lot of people's minds, and I'm not taking a position on this because it is a very controversial thing to say, that is oil speculation.
Yeah, there's speculation that the speculation is what's driving up the price.
Right. That's perfect, Chuck.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that it's being, suggested is that from, July of 2008, there were 617,000 oil futures contracts on the market. On the oil commodities market.
Can we explain what a future is real
quick?
Well,
hold on. We'll go back.
All right.
I just wanted to get this one last stat out, and we'll go
gotcha.
Back to the beginning. And then July or January of 2011.
Uh-huh.
So July of 2008, 617,000. January of 2011, 1 million futures contracts on the oil market.
Yeah, that's
right?
A lot.
And between those two times, after the last bubble burst, it's been creeping up and up and up. Prices have basically commensurate with oil futures contracts.
Right.
So it really looks a lot like it could be oil speculation that's driving up the prices.
Yes.
So let's talk about oil speculation, Josh.
Yes, and my mind starts to melt starting now.
Okay.
All right, Josh, a future, and you're going to have to help me with this, but any kind of future is a contract between a buyer and a seller.
Mm-hmm.
A buyer agrees to purchase a fixed amount of a commodity at a fixed price. In oil future, we're talking about oil, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different than actually buying into a commodity because you're just betting on whether or not it will be higher or lower at the end of your contract.
Right.
Is that correct?
A future is a derivative, and a derivative is any kind of financial contract or
right.
instrument that's the value of which is based on the value of something else.
It's, you know what it is to me, to my little brain that doesn't think about this stuff well, is it's a made-up way to make money almost.
That's exactly right.
It's like someone created this and said, hey, this doesn't even exist.
Right.
But as long as there's someone buying and selling it, it does exist.
Because so a futures contract is very standard. It's not an exotic financial instrument.
Right.
But the way that it's being used in the derivatives market is extremely exotic and volatile. So, Chuck, you have a bunch of oil. And I have a refinery over here.
Sweet.
In my backyard.
Why are we podcasting?
And, I'm saving up for a better life for
Good.
It. I want to buy some oil from you.
All right.
But I think that oil, the price of crude is going to go up, you know, a year from now.
Per barrel.
Right. And I'm going to go ahead and buy it for the market price now.
Right.
Right? And you're going to sell me a futures contract. So we have an agreement
right.
that a year from now, at the end of March 2012,
mm-hmm.
that contract expires because
right.
I have to buy that oil from you.
Yeah.
Okay?
But not now, a year from now.
Right. Now, if I'm right and oil goes up, say I'm buying 100 barrels at $50 a barrel, that's our future contract. So our contract's for $5,000.
Right.
If it goes up, if the price of oil goes up to $52 a barrel a
mm-hmm.
year from now,
right.
I just got 50 barrels of oil for $200 less than I should have paid.
It's a good deal for you.
It is. But a futures contract is also Well, it's a bet, right?
Yeah.
Because the price of oil could go down.
Right.
I said in 2012, at the end of March 2012, I'll buy those 50 barrels of oil from you for $50. But if the value of oil in March 2012 is $48 a barrel,
right,
then I'm paying $200 more than I could have if I just bought on what's called the spot market, which is I go to you, I want your oil right now, and you sell it to me for whatever the market price is.
Right. And if this sounds weird, it's not so different than betting on whether or not a stock will go up or down. It's the same thing.
It is, but in a lot of ways, it's just kind of, it's saying, it also comes into play if I don't need oil right now.
Right.
But I'm going to need it in the future, and I think it's going to go up, right?
Right.
Now, when the real bet comes in, that's when I'm saying that I think it's going to go up,
uh-huh,
I'm going to go long. That's called going long.
Yeah, and at the end of this contract, you're actually going to get oil, correct?
If you're holding the contract,
yeah,
and that I have with, uh-huh, you, then yes.
So
I
that
have
is
to
a
buy oil from you.
Right, that
you
is
can
a
come
future.
To me and be like, give me my money, I'll give you your oil.
Right, but that's an important thing to distinguish because that is a future and that means actually oil is being traded at some point.
Right, and that's a normal thing.
Right.
Okay, now that's going long if I'm betting that oil prices are going to go up. If
right.
I think oil prices are going to fall, I'll go short.
Yes.
Right? So it's virtually the same thing. We go into a contract, right? So, Chuck, let's say conversely, you think that oil's going to go down, so you're happy to sell me a futures contract.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
The price of oil goes down, right?
Yeah.
We say for, you know, $5,000.
Uh-huh.
The price of oil goes down to $48 a barrel.
Right.
And you buy that contract back from me, mm-hmm, at the market price. You just made $200.
Sweet.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's going short and there's going long. But as you said, in a standard commodities market that there's not a secondary derivatives market going on,
right,
then it ultimately there's going to be an exchange of oil.
Yes.
The secondary derivatives market, you never get caught with the contract when it expires. You're trading contracts day by day, moment by moment, yeah, as the price of oil changes up and down throughout the day.
Uh-huh.
You're making money off of those fluctuations by buying and selling, by shorting and longing the price of oil on these contracts.
And that is speculation.
That, okay, leads to what's called an artificial market.
Right.
Supply and demand no longer applies to the commodity itself. Supply and demand is also subject to the financial instruments as well.
Yeah, the whims of who has a lot of money and can affect a market.
Right.
With a big purchase.
Right.
So that's called an unstable market because it's very volatile. It's not nearly as steady as a real tangible market.
No,
artificial.
if you look at a regular commodities market where there aren't any futures or derivatives trading by anybody besides the people who actually will end up with this stuff,
uh-huh,
there's the changes, the fluctuations over, you know, a month or a year or a quarter are, you know, pennies or a buck or two here. It's when investment banks and hedge funds,
yeah,
who, by the way, when interest rates are very, very low,
right,
tend to turn to the commodities market to safely park their money, right?
Or
because they're not
going
to make much money when interest rates are low.
Right.
They turn to the commodities market. When they get involved, that's when things start going from $30 a barrel in 2004 to $140 a barrel in 2008.
Right, and that's what happened with the housing bust. All of a sudden, Wall Street, housing wasn't a good place to put any money, so Wall Street flocked over to speculation,
mm-hmm,
futures, oil futures.
Right. And we should say again that this is all very much debatable.
Yes.
This is, if you believe that oil speculation is affecting oil, this is how it happens, right?
Yeah, we're just explaining that. That's what we do.
Well, what we just explained was how derivatives trading works. This is no secret. It's the effect that it has. That's what's debatable. So the people who believe that there is consequences for oil, for derivatives trading,
yeah,
say that here's what happens, right? If you want to get your hands on actual oil,
mm-hmm,
right, you aren't going to be able to keep up with an investment bank or a hedge fund manager who is buying up futures.
Right.
So you're going to need oil now, and you're going to have to stockpile it. It's one good thing about oil is you can stockpile it for a while, right?
Well, and oil producers can hoard it.
That's exactly right as well. But there's, you can also, the derivatives market in futures can also inadvertently force a hoard among people who actually use the oil.
Right.
Who are buying oil for use, not just trading in the derivatives market.
Right.
By saying, okay, I can't buy futures because they're just too expensive right now. So I'm going to buy whatever I can get my hands on. So the spot market that deals in actual oil right that moment has a higher demand, which means the actual price of oil goes up, which means those oil futures go up even further, which means prices across the board rise, especially for gasoline.
That's right. And when big companies like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, are these huge financial institutions, are buying up tons and tons of or speculating, then that's going to have a really big sway on the market.
That alone will, right? They stand to gain tons of cash.
Tons of cash.
But imagine if you not only stood to gain tons of cash from the secondary market, but you're an oil producer as well.
Yeah, and all of a sudden you're speculating on your own production?
Or buying oil futures. If you buy a bunch of oil futures for a higher price, you can actually, the market trades on rumor. Right?
Right.
So people are like, well, somebody's buying up a bunch of this stuff, or, and the price is actually rising, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then a lot of people are going to be willing to pay more and more and more. If you're an oil producer doing that, then you're going to stand to gain through the financial instruments and through the actual sale of your oil. And there was an investigation into this, the secondary oil markets, that found that in the New York Mercantile Exchange alone, which is the commodities market, or one of them for the U.S., 11% of the oil futures contracts were owned by Vitol, which is a Swiss oil producer.
Yeah.
So how, Chuck, how can an oil company be allowed to artificially inflate the price of oil for its own gains? And how can investment banks be allowed to drive up the price, if that is in fact what's going on? How can they be allowed to drive up the price of a commodity as valuable as oil, if normally it should be something like $30 or $40 or $50 a barrel, and it's double or triple or quadruple what experts believe its actual value should be?
Well, it shouldn't be able to happen, because they're starting in 1974 with our Congress, there was something put in place called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, and they were put in place specifically to prevent this kind of thing from speculation, artificially inflating prices of commodities. So they were like, they'd realized a long time ago this could be a real problem. Let's put this thing in place and let's make them keep it in check. So if you were trading on that exchange, you got to file reports every day. Mm-hmm. The commission looks them over, keeps an eye out for speculation.
They know if somebody's trying to corner the market. They
sure.
know who.
And they try to stop it.
Yeah.
But quite a few things have happened to neuter, for the most part, the CFTC.
Yeah, because you can create a federal agency and empower it all you want. But if successive presidents disagree with you about the value of that agency, they can neglect it, they can strip it of its powers, they can, as you say, neuter it, and not even have the courtesy to put nudicles on it afterward. Just leave it laying there, you know?
So in 2000, a very big thing happened. Prices were still pretty low for oil, less than $30 a barrel. But a little company called Enron started lobbying Congress to remove regulatory powers of the CFTC. And basically what the deal was, the CFTC had regulatory powers over the official exchange.
Right.
So Enron says,
The New York Mercantile Exchange.
Yeah. And Enron said, hey, you know, we've got this software that allows futures to be traded over the counter, which is something outside of the formal exchange market.
Right. It's basically like I can say, hey, Chuck, you've got a bunch of futures like in your pocket. Can I come to your house and buy it?
Yeah.
And it'll be a legitimate exchange, but it's over the counter. It exists outside of the market.
That's right.
Right.
And that became known as the Enron loophole, because all of a sudden OTC trading was allowed for futures exchanges with no government oversight, because it was out of the jurisdiction of the CFTC. So, Josh, that was one thing. Happened in 2000. Then another little thing came along. Called the Intercontinental Exchange. The ICE was set up in London, and that was to trade European oil futures. And the funny thing about that is it was headquartered here in Atlanta. So it's headquartered in Atlanta, but it's European oil futures. So the CFTC didn't have any oversight over them because it was European.
Right. So you could trade American oil futures on this exchange.
Well, 6 years later, that's when they set up the American terminals that allowed that.
Think about it. Like, the time in London and the time in New York are totally different, and that's kind of a problem.
Right.
So, really, if you can get these commodities, the same commodities, trading on the same time zone, you can really create a you have a more robust market.
That's right. And now, all of a sudden, the CFTC couldn't even regulate these formal exchanges on the formal market.
Right.
Even though it was based in Atlanta,
yeah.
They set up terminals inside the United States.
In New York.
But
at the NYMEX exchange.
It's almost like the OTB. Like, oh, horse racing's illegal, but this race is in Cuba.
Right.
But you can bet on it on the Lower East Side.
Yes. And so as these things just kept going and going, the CFTC just lost any jurisdiction whatsoever. And
very crafty people that are coming up with these things.
Yes.
They're basically saying, like, let's set up a way where we can make gobs of money outside of regulation.
And I mean outside of regulation.
Yeah.
People have no idea. I was reading some blog post, and it was about how the aluminum market was being cornered by somebody.
Really?
And they thought it was some hedge fund manager, and they had an idea who, but not enough to publish. But they have no idea who's buying what. It all exists in the shadows. The derivatives market do, because it's outside of the jurisdiction of this federal agency that was created specifically to police these things.
You know, I'm never going to be wealthy.
What?
Because I'm one of those dumb schlubs who's just like, let me go out and earn my paycheck. Mm. And I'm not like against the stock market. Like, I'll invest in the stock market,
sure,
and set up my 401k and all that. But yeah. I can't even fathom the kind of what causes someone to think of, like, hey, how can I really make tons of money with no oversight?
Yeah.
And I'll invent this way to trade ether and not real ether.
People would buy ether from me,
probably,
especially
would.
Drug dealers. Patrick Bateman would have eaten you alive.
Yeah. Oh man, I'd be so dead. So there was a July 2008 report by the International Energy Agency that concluded that speculation didn't really have anything to do with it. They were like, no, that's not what's driving oil prices up.
Yeah.
There was another report the next September contradicted the IEA report. It said, no, there's actually a lot of correlations between this big influx of money in oil futures,
mm-hmm,
and the rising cost of oil. I mean, I'm a dummy. To me, it kind of looks plain that that's probably what's been happening. But there's probably a lot of people are going to write and say, oh, what you guys didn't consider was XYZ.
No, there's a lot of factors that go into producing and buying and selling oil. And there's no way you can cover all of them. And that's not the point. And I don't think that's anybody who's accusing the speculation of influencing the price.
Right.
That's not the point of anybody, because it's not, there's nobody who's going to say this is 100% of the problem. There's,
sure,
other stuff that does have this effect.
Oh yeah.
I think what gets people to say speculation is having an effect is because there's people out there who's like, it has no effect. And that's just not possible, that a million futures contracts can't have,
yeah,
some effect on the end price. And it is just correlated. It's not causal.
Yeah, but oil shot up so quickly.
Exactly.
Right along with it. It was,
yeah.
I don't know.
And I mean, ultimately, what it comes down to is the average American who's still, you know, maybe unemployed, paying tons of money for food, is getting, you know, reamed at the pump still. And if there's anything that could be done to reduce that without causing harm to the markets,
right,
why not?
But hey, good news, Josh. In 2008, Congress introduced the Consumer First. Hey, how about that? Consumers First.
Right.
The Energy Act in May 2008.
Yeah.
And that would have extended oversight for the CFTC to foreign lands.
Yeah.
Probably would have helped a lot. And it died on the Senate floor.
A month later. Yeah.
They said Consumer First. Yeah, let's kill it.
They're talking about it now. Like, this whole Obama push is basically making the oil companies out to be bad guys. So the Democrats are really they're banging the war drum against,
right,
oil companies right now. And investment bankers are a fun target too. So this is coming up again.
Right.
But it's coming up like it did in 2008 because oil speculation is rampant.
And I know everyone thinks we're anti-capitalism, but that's not true at all. It was,
no,
just play fair.
Absolutely untrue.
Just play fair.
Or at the very least, admit that you're having the effect that you're having.
Right.
That's what I think would gall anybody who is like, yes, oil speculation has an effect.
Right.
And it's not just oil, by the way. If you want to read a really cool article on speculation, commodity speculation. Read Frederick Kaufman's The Food Bubble. He tries very hard but fails ultimately in the end to connect Goldman Sachs trading wheat and creating a wheat bubble mm-hmm. that created the food crisis and the riots in Haiti and Egypt in 2008.
Wow.
But he failed to connect it. He came so close, but he wasn't able to.
Right.
But it's worth a read anyway. That was in Harper's like last year.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that is oil speculation. It's us speculating on oil speculation, or speculating as little as we can, right?
Right.
If you want to learn more about that, type in oil in the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com. We have a bunch of cool stuff on the site about that. And I said oil, followed by handy search bar, which means listener mail.
Josh, I'm going to call this sperm donation. Dear Josh, Chuck, and Jerry. But I'm going to say Lizzie today.
Yeah.
Because Jerry has left us.
Say it again.
Dear Josh, Chuck, and Lizzie.
Yeah.
My name is Melanie. I'm a college student from Seattle, attending full-time school in South Korea. I was listening to How Twins Work, and it made me think of my own unique family situation. My mom and legal father, her husband, could not have a child together, so they decided to get a sperm donor. The laws are looser now, but 20 years ago, information was more closed off and secretive. I grew up not knowing really anything about my real dad until just about a month ago. In late February, the day before I was to depart back to South Korea, I got a letter in the mail from my real father. He lives in Athens, Georgia. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
We have been communicating through Facebook and email, and I've discovered that we have quite a bit in common, despite never knowing each other. Of course you do. Genes, baby. It's all the genes.
I wonder if it turned out to be Biker Lee.
We have very similar handwriting, religious, spiritual beliefs, paranormal experiences.
Sounds like Biker Lee.
TV show taste. He is a nurse, and that was the first job I ever wanted. So it's not Biker Lee.
No, it's not.
And he was a journalist, and my main talent and a large interest of mine is writing. On top of all this, 5 years ago or so, my mom received a letter from a lady who had registered the same donor number. So, in short, I also have a half-brother.
That is cool.
That is very cool. We were able to meet once, actually, my senior year, and also discovered we had several things in common. My boyfriend was a part Japanese guy named Max. And as was his best friend, a part Japanese guy named Max.
Wow.
Same political views, both played guitar, same favorite band. Half brother, half sister, reunited.
Does she say the same favorite band?
She doesn't mention what the band is.
Oh, okay.
But she said this leads me to my request that we do an episode on sperm and egg donation and how relationships can develop. So let's add that to the kitty.
Okay.
To the queue.
Yeah, let's do that.
That's Melanie A.
Thanks a lot, Melanie. I'm glad you got to come down to Athens for a little while, right?
No, she did not come down. She just was in contact.
You definitely have to go to Athens.
Oh, yeah.
And while you're there, make sure you eat at Harry Bassett's. I strongly recommend the chicken Rochambeau.
Okay.
And they do not kick you in the crotch when you order it. I promise. This isn't like a prank.
No.
If you were produced outside of the traditional means of reproduction, we want to hear about it.
Yeah, good one.
Wrap it up, send it in an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?